brand new attending at the University of Washington, former fellow in endocrinology, writer, and Bollywood critic. Let's learn about today's guest, Dr. Farah Naz Khan. Our guest today, Dr. Farah Naz Khan, she was an endocrinology fellow at Emory University School of Medicine. She will be shortly starting at the University of Washington as an attending. She earned her bachelor's in environmental engineering from MIT in 2009, went straight to medical school, and graduated from the University of Alabama's Medical School at Birmingham in 2013. She did her residency in internal medicine at Emory and recently completed her endocrinology residency at Emory with a particular interest in diabetes in the developing world and equal access to endocrinological care for all patient populations. In addition, she is a published author with bylines in The Daily Beast, The Atlantic, Vox.com, Scientific American, HuffPost India, and more. Oh, and one more thing. She is a Bollywood expert. Farah, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Now, can you tell us a little bit about your background? Where did you grow up? What do you like to do for fun today, etc.?
Sure. I was born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama, so a product of the Deep South. Was there until I graduated high school, at which point I went to Boston for undergrad at MIT. After 4 years in the cold Northeast, I decided I needed to come back home where it was a little bit
defrost.
Warmer. Defrost. Yeah, get a little more acclimated to temperatures I like. So I spent 4 years at the University of Alabama at Birmingham Medical School. Then I wanted a bigger city, but still wanted to stay closer to home. So I headed over to Atlanta, and I didn't leave until I completed my training, like you mentioned, residency and fellowship. And now I've found myself on the West Coast. And so here I am.
And now you're in Seattle, where it's a little colder, but it's not quite as cold as Boston.
Exactly. It doesn't really snow here that much. So Seattle had that plus.
Right. And it's absolutely gorgeous there.
Yes, exactly.
It's really, really lovely. How did you go from an undergrad degree in environmental engineering to immediately starting medical school? I mean, when did you know that you wanted to be a doctor?
So medicine and being a doctor was always in the cards for me. I was pre-med from, you know, day one of college. My dad had this thing that he told all three of his kids. He says, you can do whatever you want with your life, but I want you to get an engineering undergraduate degree first.
Really?
Yes. His point was that, you know, if you change your mind about something, then you always have that degree to fall back on. That's why I chose engineering. But also being an engineering major kind of helps me view problems and things from a different mindset. So I really loved getting those skills while also getting ready for medical school.
Okay, great. My brother-in-law is actually a physician who did his undergrad in engineering.
Okay.
And he really uses it. I'm blanking on a specialty right now, whatever. He was a physician for many years and moved into administration at a very large HMO. And
okay.
He has used many times a systems approach to address medical problems he was a pathologist. Use a systems approach to deal with issues and problems in the HMO.
Right, exactly. And over the course of medical school, it's funny, I actually struggled the first 2 years of medical school because the way medical school wants you to learn is very different than the way you learn as an engineering undergrad. Mm-hmm. But all of my advisors encouraged me to just keep pushing forward because they said, I used to regret actually being an engineering major, right? I was like, man, I should have just done something so that these classes wouldn't be so hard. But they encouraged me and they said that, trust me, your training as an undergrad will really, really benefit you when you're in your clinical years and treating patients and going forward in your career. And they were right. It really has made a big difference.
How was the method of learning different? Or what skills did you differently need?
Engineers are taught to problem solve, right? You are given your tools and, you know, here's this problem set and you do it. Many of our tests were open book. Our homework and things like that may have been open book too. Not that that made it easy. It's just that it was more of a problem solving focus. Whereas in medicine, a lot of your initial classes require a lot of memorization. Pathology, microbiology, anatomy. There's a lot of memorization and just adjusting from a very problem solving based studying regimen to a very memorization-based study regimen was very difficult for me.
Okay. And are you happy you went straight from undergrad to medical school? And why or why not?
I would have to say I'm going to waffle on that and say that there's okay. I do wish I had taken some time off. But at the same time, I'm also glad that I was able to finish when I finished, because time off would have just meant more time until getting to you being a quote unquote real doctor. The reason I wish I had taken some time off is because once you're in medical school and then you go through this training, it's the momentum just kind of keeps up with you. And then it's hard to really find a break. Whereas a gap between undergrad and med school is a perfect time to kind of get a break before you're in that cycle of, I got to finish.
Right. It seems like that cycle kind of never ends.
This is true. This is true. Yeah.
What did you like best about your experience at the University of Alabama Medical School?
What I really appreciated about UAB, that's at, you know, University of Alabama at Birmingham, is that the professors and the mentors that I found there were so supportive from day one. I had people who were, I really wanted to do work in India. That was kind of my thing. I wanted to go back and do global work in India. I didn't really have any connections there. I didn't have any well-established research there. All of our family had moved out. But UAB helped me make it happen. They found me the funding resources. Yeah, it was incredible. They also didn't have much experience with global health work in India. But they were like, there's this medical student. She really wants to do it. She has the drive and the initiative. So we're going to help her. And I got funding. I was plugged in with the right research mentors. And that pattern just kind of continued through all 4 years there. Everybody was so supportive. And when I was deciding residencies, I'll never forget, you know, the internal medicine program director there and the assistant program directors there. I used to tell them, I was like, I don't want you guys to feel bad that I'm not staying at UAB. And they said, no, you know, we understand, you know, wherever you go, you'll carry on UAB's good name. So you shouldn't feel guilty about that. So they were just always so supportive. And I'll never forget that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And how did you decide to focus on internal medicine and then later on endocrinology?
So the big... Yeah, the big split point, I think, in medical school for many medical students is, am I going to go the surgical or the non-surgical route? And for me, that was very early decided that the only surgical route I ever considered was ophthalmology. But after doing a couple of rotations, I realized that wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. And from there, I realized that internal medicine was really where I wanted to be. Primary care and chronic disease management were kind of what really stood out to me, building that continuity of care with your patients and the sort of longstanding relationship. Mm-hmm. So I knew internal medicine was going to happen. And I actually knew even going into internal medicine that I was probably going to do endocrinology, just because on a personal note, my father, who's, you know, very healthy seeming guy, very thin, he's always struggled with actually type 2 diabetes. And so I knew that I always wanted to kind of focus on that. And in medical school, I loved the engineer in me loved that in theory, in the endocrinology, all the hormones, if they're doing their job appropriately, if one doesn't work, you should be able to trace your way back in a system and try to figure out what went wrong. And so that really appealed to me.
That's very interesting. So you're trying to figure out like what causes the pancreas to shut down or to stop producing insulin. Is that what you're
sort of, or like take, you know, cause there's always primary, secondary, and even tertiary hormone issues. And so if you look at it kind of in a system focus, right, diabetes aside, then I like that you could, in theory, I say in theory because the body is a lot more complicated, you could kind of trace your way back and solve a mystery. And that's kind of what really appealed to me about endocrinology.
So I guess it goes back to engineering.
Yes, it
does. Was there ever a time, either in medical school or since, when you really wondered if you had made a mistake and thought about leaving medicine? And I don't mean so much the initial frustration that you experienced, let's say, because you had to move more from a problem solving to a memorization mode of learning. I mean more when you started with patient interactions and rotations and ultimately residency and fellowship.
Yes, definitely. you know, at the very beginning of medical school at UAB, they made us do this exercise, which at the time seemed very cheesy. They made us write down a mission statement, and they were like, trust us, you're going to need to look back at this. And my mission statement, I don't remember verbatim, was something along the lines of, remember that you wanted to do this. You've always wanted to do this. And remember the people who have supported you to help you get to here. And on my most depressing days, on certain surgical rotations that I just found miserable because of also the work and maybe the people weren't as nice to me as I would have liked, I would just remember that mission statement. And that got me through medical school. Because in medical school, you're still protected. You have these frustrating experiences and the clinical work is hard and draining. And you realize that seeing patients, while it's very rewarding and it's a privilege, it's also very tiring and stressful. What you're protected from as a medical student is a lot of the bureaucracy of medicine and just the barriers we face with dealing with our healthcare system and what our patients go through. And that loss of protection that happened when I started intern year, when I was really on the ground taking care of patients and a lot of times feeling like it was an uphill battle against the system, those things, I contemplated taking a year off after my intern year, my first year of residency, slash taking a year off might have meant maybe never completing residency, right? Like, who knows? But I remember one of my internal medicine program advisors told me, she said, I know you're going through a really hard time and I know that this is hard for you, but trust me, this is the one of the hardest years of your residency. And if you can just power through and get through this, then we can talk about you taking a break, you know, in another year or two. But right now, just she just encouraged me to power through. And I owe her. I owe her. Otherwise, yeah, who knows? Maybe I wouldn't have finished.
What do you think? I mean, I'm sure you know. What made that year so difficult? Was it the sheer hours? Was it that you now had to deal more with the bureaucracy? Was it, lack of patient compliance or seeing what some of your patients were up against? What was it that made that transition so, so difficult?
You know, when you hit
sick people.
Right. It's honestly, it's all of the above. You go from being a medical student who is kind of not spoon fed, but in a way, like really guided by your residents and your attending and, you know, you're polished, right? Your presentations are just perfect because you're not really having to spend time putting in the orders and taking care of all the nitty gritty details usually. Right. And then you're thrown into the hospital on day one with your new long white coat. And you go from student to the primary care provider for very sick patients in the hospital setting. And the hours are demanding. And then just the small details of how do I put this order in on the computer? How can I get in touch with this nurse or this respiratory therapist? Or where is the cafeteria? I mean, just everything. It can be very overwhelming. And compound just the overwhelming new job with the very real and very often emotional and mentally exhausting task of dealing with very sick patients who are dealing with very hard circumstances. Sure. And it just takes a huge toll.
Oh, that makes sense. I like to ask this question of physicians, especially newer physicians, because I think almost everyone says yes. And I don't, not all, some say no, there were some hard times, but I never really doubted the decision. But most say that, yes, there was a point where they doubted the decision. Mm-hmm. And I think that most pre-meds don't anticipate that.
Yeah, and I think it's very true because when you're a pre-med, the idea of ever regretting the goal that you've set yourself for so long.
And work so hard
at. Far-fetched. Exactly. And day in and out, night and day, you know, gunning for that 4.0 GPA, that top-notch MCAT score, getting the research and the shadowing experience. You're so busy in all of that and trying to achieve this goal that the thought of maybe regretting this as a career decision would never even occur. It just is not something that anybody would even think about. My number one advice, I have a lot of pre-meds who ask me for help and things like this. And my number one advice is that make sure you're doing this for the right reasons, right? And what I mean by that is that this career is what you want to do. It's not what somebody else wants you to do. It's not something you're doing because you think you can make a lot of money. Because at the end of the day, what matters when you're ready to call it quits is that the only way you'll keep going is if it is really something that you wanted to do.
Right. As a matter of fact, we had on the podcast a few weeks ago, and I'll link to it from our show notes, Calvin's son, the show notes would be at accepted.com/280. We're no longer in the 100s, a long time. We're way far away from the 100s. And it's also, it's accepted.com/254. And he initially didn't want to become a doctor because it was something his father really wanted him to do. Mm. And he didn't want to do it because his father wanted him to do it. And he didn't want to, and then he didn't want to, then his father, unfortunately, tragically passed away very suddenly.
Oh, no.
And then, you know, he didn't want to do it because his father had wanted it. And he also didn't not want to do it just because of that reason.
Just because of that. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So he was in a little bit of a quandary, and much to his surprise, he applied and actually got in. And then he felt, well, now I really got to do it. and he found out that he loves it. So he's very happy. Okay. And again, we'll definitely link to that. But I think the advice, make sure you're doing it because it's something that you really want to do it and that you have the right reasons for wanting to do it. And that you know that there are going to be tough times. And also,
exactly.
I mean, when you're dealing with very sick people, it's not only that they are, I mean, they might be unconscious, so they're not really reactive, but their family sure is.
Mm-hmm.
The loved ones mm-hmm. sure are, and they can be really difficult and not necessarily appreciative.
Right. And things can change on a dime in the hospital. And the unfortunate part about, I think, being an intern is that you're expected to do and expected to take care of patients, but you're also not really expected to know that much because you're still, quote unquote, just a first year resident. Yeah. And so a lot of times making big decisions is tough if you feel like you don't necessarily have the support from your upper level residents or your attendings and things like that. It's kind of being a first year resident for that reason, I think, is very difficult because you're in this kind of new territory and figuring out power balances and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's turn away from your medical career and turn to some of the other things that you do in your plentiful spare time.
Right? Sure.
So,
yeah.
Can you discuss your love-hate relationship with Bollywood?
Oh yeah, man, we go way back, me and Bollywood.
First define what is Bollywood?
So Bollywood is basically one of the world's largest film industries. It's the mm-hmm. film industry in India that's based out of Mumbai, which used to be Bombay, used to be Bombay, and hence the Bollywood. To most people mm-hmm. who don't watch Bollywood, and even people who watch Bollywood, will tell you that large majority of the movies dating back to the earliest Bollywood films, you know, mm-hmm. are often romances, and there's song, and there's dance, and there's great costumes, and there's good-looking people. And for me, Bollywood, when I was a child and didn't really know much more beyond these surface-level things, was about kind of connecting to a country that I had never been to. My family left. You know, I was born and raised here, but I always felt a really strong tie to our South Asian culture. So I used to use the movies to kind of connect to that. And the movies and the music was that connection. And as I got older, this pure love for Bollywood shaped, kind of morphed into this love-hate relationship because I was able to kind of see beyond the superficial things and kind of be like, huh, I don't really like the message that's being delivered in this movie about a woman's role in society, for example, right?
Okay. Which
frequently is portrayed as, you know, the woman belongs in the kitchen and her duty is to serve her husband, etc. Right? So, and that's not every Bollywood movie. Bollywood has actually come a long way over the years, but there are many movies that are misogynistic and chauvinistic and the industry is trying to change. But those things flew over my head when I was a kid.
Sure.
And as an adult, I watched the movies that I used to love as a kid and be like, wait a minute. There was actually a Bollywood movie I watched in the past, I want to say 5 to 7 years, which actually kind of merged my worlds. It was a Bollywood movie that really just mistreated the presentation of mental health. Hmm. One of the main characters had they were trying to show depression and anxiety. And they just totally mishandled it. And I actually wrote an entire article about that. looking not just at using that movie as like the hinge point, but then also finding many examples of how Bollywood has mishandled mental health. And that's just one example of kind of where the love-hate relationship kind of comes from.
Right. Now, I think I saw at least one article where you were discussing the misogynistic aspects of Bollywood and quite critical of it. And we're going to link to your website. So if anybody wants more examples of this, then you can find Farah's articles on the topic there. Now, I read, as I just said, several of your articles, and you are an excellent writer who has commented on a wide range of topics. And we mentioned Bollywood, but obviously a lot of your writing deals with medicine. What do you like to write about, and how do you find the time to do so?
So writing for me started actually as an outlet to kind of cope with the stress of residency. I started my blog my fourth year of medical school, and then in residency, my intern year, I was writing a lot of things for online Bollywood or South Asian blogs, basically. Then as I got into my later years of residency, I kind of branched out and decided to comment on healthcare issues, specifically with the purpose of kind of trying to demystify the world of the hospital and the clinic for people who are not there. Because we all know that it's really hard to navigate the healthcare system when you're not in it. Even when you're in it, it's a challenge. And so with my healthcare writing, I try to kind of just clear up some things that I think are confusing or controversial and try to help educate the general public.
All right. Thanks. One of the articles that you wrote was a scathing critique of the flexible work rules for residents, which resulted in residents like you working 30-hour shifts in an ICU. And this was, I think, for the Daily Beast. Do you want to comment on that? I mean, when I first started Accepted, I don't think there were work rules for residents.
Right. And, you know, the whole work hours and duty hours and shifting for residents, it's an ongoing argument. And there's arguments for both sides. And when I wrote that article, I was in the throes of a rotation, which, you know, removed the duty hour caps. And that's kind of why I wrote, you know, the critique of it, because I was experiencing it. And I personally did not think that the removal of the cap was good for my patients.
I can imagine. I mean, you can't do great work with no sleep. I mean, it's
right with no sleep, even though on that rotation, I implemented a napping shift thing for our team so that we all got a little bit of sleep. And even still, I felt like I was not operating at my best. And since that article was actually published, so that article was written, the reason they removed the caps was because of this thing called the iCompare study. And since that article was written, they actually have published parts of the results of iCompare, but not all. And what they basically found was that there's no difference between, you know, flexible duty hours versus having duty hour caps. And they're still remaining to publish some other things as far as, I believe, patient outcomes, et cetera, remain to be published. And so it'll be interesting to see what that shows.
So there's no difference in patient satisfaction or resident satisfaction? If the outcomes, they don't have
difference in resident education. Because one of the big arguments is that resident education suffers at the hands of the duty hour caps.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so there was no difference in resident education. I can't quote me on the specific results of this, but the results were published in the New England Journal of Medicine, I want to say 2 to 3 months ago, initial results, and they're still doing more analysis. The study is now closed, finished. But the reason I wrote that specific article, aside from obviously wanting to talk about my opinion, was because I feel like a lot of people outside of medicine don't really understand what the duty hours entailed and what a removal of the cap and what flexible duty hours and all of these things, what that even means. So that's why, you know, I believe the title of that specific article also was like what it's like when your doctor's on a 30-hour shift.
Yeah, well, they're obviously sleep deprived.
Yeah, exactly, to say the least. The most harrowing thing about this whole thing is that when you ask patients what they want, they would want a well-rested doctor. So there has to be a way. There has to be a way to kind of balance what is needed, obviously, in our healthcare system, because the demand is huge for needing doctors on the job and taking care of patients, and also balancing the well-being of those doctors.
Right. And now we've been kind of talking about some of the things that you didn't like about, you know, either your training or being a doctor. But overall, you are happy with your choice of profession, correct?
Yeah, I'm at the, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, as I tell people. Not to sound like a negative Nancy by any means, you know, it's hard. And I like to be honest and upfront about that.
All right. And no, I think that's valuable. And that's why I've kind of led, I mean, I've asked the questions that I've asked, but let's be a positive Patricia. Okay.
yeah, exactly.
What do you like about it?
So what we're able to do as physicians and take care of our patients and get so integrally involved with improving somebody's health is a huge privilege and is something that you just can't find in any other career. Every career helps people on some level. You know, I came into medicine because I wanted to help people. That was, as cliche as it sounds, that was the number one reason I came in. And I could have done that in any number of ways. But I'm glad I picked medicine because I know that if at the end of the day, no matter how much you help somebody, if you can't help them with their health, it's really hard to really look at much else in life if you don't have your health. And one of my UAB medical school mentors said that she used to always say, she was like, we are so privileged to be able to take care of patients when they're at people, you know, humans, when they're at their most vulnerable. And that really is very unique. And it's something that really only doctors get.
Right. How do you see your career evolving now that you're about to embark on, you know, the non-training part of your career?
Yeah. So the job I've accepted at University of Washington is a clinical assistant professor. And what I love about, you know, this role in an academic medical center is that I get lots of clinical time. You know, I'll have my own clinic and we'll see my own patients.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. But then I'm part of this bigger group and this bigger division where there's a lot of resources to help me get into involved in things like teaching medical students or getting involved with other research projects or trying to figure out how to bring back the global health piece of my passions from the past. Right. So that's kind of how I see myself going forward as I get my feet wet as being an attending soon, which is very scary actually also in and of itself. But that's kind of how I see myself going forward.
And were you able to, well, I guess at the University of Alabama, you were able to nurture the global health interests. Have you been able to do anything with it since?
It was very fortunate to be able to nurture it at Emory as well. Through Emory had a global health residency scholars program that I was very active in part of. And I actually set up their very first site in India, which was great. And that was all during residency. Unfortunately, during fellowship, I didn't really get a chance to take part in that, not because of any fault in my fellowship program, but, you know, life happened. You know, I got married and lots of other things were happening.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I just didn't really get time. So I'm hoping to continue to build on that. University of Washington has a very impressive, you know, global health presence and a huge school of public health. So hopefully there will be opportunities here as well.
Okay. And what would you have liked me to ask you?
Maybe if there was, what's the number one advice that I could give somebody who wants to go into medical school?
Go for it.
Do it if you want to do it. And don't let naysayers like me tell you that it's not for you, et cetera, et cetera. If you can't handle us telling you the not positive parts, then sit down and talk to one of us before you apply. Because if you want to do it, I encourage you to do it, but just make sure you're doing it with non-rose tinted glasses.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you very much, Farah. I think we're just about finished. So much for sharing your insight, the positive and the negative, both negative Nancy and positive Patricia. They were both here today. So thank you again for sharing your story and your insight and being so generous with your time. Where can listeners find you online to learn more about you or read your articles and get this non-rose colored perspective?
Yes, of course. So I am on Twitter at my handle is my first name, Farah 287. And then you can also find me on my website. There's, you know, a contact form there also. And so that's the best way to keep up with me and the next articles, etc.
Okay, great. We're going to link to Farah's site as well as to her Twitter feed and some other resources related to this podcast from exhibit.com/280. Listener, thank you too for joining Dr. Farah Naz Khan and me for Admission Straight Talk's 280th episode. Final reminder and a favor. First, a reminder from our sponsor, don't miss The Ultimate Guide to Medical School Interview Success. We'll also link to the download page from the show notes at exhibit.com/280. And the favor, if you find the show worthwhile, please leave a review on iTunes for Admission Straight Talk. We have links to iTunes in the show notes at exhibit.com/280. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.